Thanks to Mike and the rest of the team at Rollbar for sponsoring this episode of Does Not Compute. Anyone who's deployed an app before knows how important good error monitoring is. Rollbar makes dealing with errors way simpler. Instead of digging through logs and relying on user-reported errors, they automatically alert you whenever something goes wrong. Rollbar has a bunch of client libraries, which means it just takes a few minutes to integrate them with your app, no matter what language or framework it's written in. Big names like Heroku, Kayak, Twilio, Instacart, Zendesk, and Twitch all use Rollbar, so you know that they scale, and you know they're going to reliably notify you when something goes wrong. Head over to rollbar.com/DNC to check out Rollbar, and when you sign up via that link, you'll get 90 days of their Bootstrap plan for free. That's up to 300,000 errors totally free. Hit up rollbar.com/DNC today.
So, Sean, what do you think of these unlimited private repos on GitHub?
Which person are you asking? Are you asking the individual, or are you asking the person who works for a company that was going to use GitHub?
Well, I guess technically I'm asking both, but let's start with the individual, huh?
I think it's awesome. I think that how they change the pricing, it's just good for the common person, right? So the common person, you can now pay $7 a month and you get unlimited repositories, unlimited private repositories. For me, that's great because I didn't really have a big enough need to pay more money than that. I already was paying for the micro plan, I think it was, or the small plan. But for me now, I can just kind of archive things there. Or if I have projects I'm working on that don't really need to be open sourced, I can just store them there, which I guess makes me feel a little bit safer having them backed up like that. But we were at Octus, we were looking at using GitHub for all of our Git stuff. Right now we use an internal GitLab server, which works fine. But GitHub, I think the main selling point was that integrations just are easier to use with GitHub, and it's faster. It's an order of magnitude faster than GitLab. But now I think we would have to be paying somewhere around $200, $250 a month for that. And I don't know that right now it justifies the price difference of $50 a month for our GitLab on a Droplet.
Yeah, I mean, from the individual perspective, I'm incredibly stoked. I was also paying for, I don't know, one of the smaller plans, but I was constantly hitting the private repo limit. And a lot of those are just old, weird little side projects that I was working on that were never ready to release and stuff like that. So it was always kind of frustrating having to balance, I want this on GitHub, but it's not really a public thing. It's just kind of a goofy side project. So I want it to be private, but I don't want to pay more. And that was always weird. And I mean, I've already blown past my previous private repo limit since they announced unlimited private repos. And it's awesome. I feel like I can just put any weird little thing I make in GitHub as private and just have it live there and be safe and work on it in a nice way that I'm familiar with. Because at Imagix, we use GitHub for all of our source control stuff. So most of my communication around code happens in GitHub already. So it's just so nice to have that one place where I can pay $7 a month and just have all of my code there, private or public. That's so, so cool on the individual side.
Yeah, I mean, sure, it's great for you because there's lots of context switching. For me, for Octopus at least, we do all of our open source stuff on GitHub and we have everything internally, including all of our client feedback. The designers also get added to the project repo so they can add issues. They can help us kind of make sure that things stay consistent. So on any given day, there's a lot of switching back and forth, which sometimes gets confusing for me, but I mean, it's not the end of the world, you know? I think that even though I'm choosing not to move everything over to GitHub, I think that GitHub's pricing for organizations is fine. I think it's totally fair. People, you know, the general public that might use GitHub, I think this is a better deal for them, but you know, corporations tend to have more money than individuals, so it makes sense that it would be more expensive for them. So I feel like it balances out the pricing tiers.
Yeah, and when you really look at it, it's $25 a month for the first 5 users, I think, and then $9 a month per user after that. And that is really cheap in the grand scheme of things, for a company at least. When you look at tools like Slack, which doesn't store and back up all your code and give you all the collaboration tools around code that GitHub does, you're paying about the same amount per user per month, and people have no problem with that. So I think that this is an awesome move. I'm really excited to see how this helps GitHub move forward.
Yeah, I am too. I mean, So after they announced it, I got three maybe emails like really shortly after where I was being removed from old organizations that I belonged to. You know, some of them were clients that I did work for years ago and they just kept me in their organization. And then the email started rolling in like, you've been removed from X organization. So for me, it seems like it caused a lot of people to kind of clean things up, right? Update the state of things, update who has control over what or access to what, which I thought was kind of nice.
Yeah. And I mean, I think a lot of that is just because people were using GitHub differently because of how the pricing structure worked for organizations at the time. I think specifically Statamic would be a great example of this. Everybody, and this is, I think, hundreds of people, everybody who was using Statamic and was in the beta was actually added to their organization. So that would have been, whatever, thousands of dollars a month for them. And obviously, that's not sustainable for something that's just goofy, like inviting people to a beta. That doesn't make sense. So I think that some use cases like that kind of don't exist anymore, and that's a bit of a bummer. But overall, this seems like a positive change to me.
Yeah, I think so too. And really, that was the kind of the tipping point as to why I decided to not move Octopus's stuff over to GitHub, was because I would end up paying a bunch for clients that need access to this project or that project, and also adding users for the designers who would really not use GitHub only except for adding issues or commenting on issues or answering questions in GitHub. And I suppose that's important, but maybe that's not the right place for it. We have it set up in GitLab. Obviously, we can have as many users as we want because we're hosting it ourselves. But sometimes it becomes a lot of chatter in the issue flow. So it's hard to distinguish between what actually is a bug and what someone labeled as a bug, but not, might not be a bug, and what's actually just a discussion happening. Granted, you can, I mean, you can search by labels, but that doesn't mean that the labels are getting used correctly. But I guess all that to say, like, I think that, you know, I think it's a good move by GitHub. I think it's a totally fair move by GitHub. I saw a lot of people complaining about it, but people will complain about anything. People will complain about me mentioning a flat LaCroix on the air because they think that's disgusting. So yeah, no, I think it's a positive move. And I, since, what has it been, a few days now? I think I've already created 4 or 5 new private repos on GitHub.
Yeah, I've only done 2. I'm just not that prolific, but it has been great. So speaking of internal communication tools and all that kind of stuff, you were actually just telling me about something you set up at Octopus recently called the Playbook.
Yes.
What's that all about?
It's an idea that I stole directly from Thoughtbot. Just being honest there. No, so
I mean, that seems like a great start. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. So I was looking at how they do things, and it's just a list of, this is how we do things at Thoughtbot, which I thought was interesting. But there had been a number of, not necessarily problems, but things that are more distracting for me at work, I guess. So things like having to answer questions, not that that's a bad thing, and I'm not trying to make myself out to be a curmudgeon, because sometimes I can be, but I try not to be. But you know, like when you're in the middle of trying to do something and someone asks you a question, you've already answered it, right? You may have already answered that question for that person maybe a few weeks ago, or you know, that answer might be actually serviceable from a Google search, but the person just needs an answer, right? So they message you. So I started thinking about it, and I think the thing that we could do to smooth things out, the dev workflow that is, between like business dev answering or asking questions and designers asking questions and things like that, would be to just write the stuff all down, because it was happening in kind of private Slack conversations before. Like I would get a message from this person and that person, and that stuff would never get documented, right? So essentially questions would come up again, like, is there a better way than the way you previously answered this question? So I talked to the other developers about it, and they liked the idea. And so Chris just kind of put one together for us.
This is super interesting to me, because Imagix was actually, we've kind of been struggling with some of the same issues around conversations happening in Slack and answers being figured out, but then never shared and distributed appropriately. So we actually ended up putting out something that's at least sounds like it's very similar, which is called the Imagix Home. And it's basically just a company wiki. It's nothing that fancy, but it's a place where all of the answers go. And that can be anything from a high level overview of all the projects we're running down to meta stuff, kind of like how to load or unload the dishwasher. It's everything related to what you need to know about the company goes there. And it's just answers. There's no discussions. There's no questions in there. It's literally just, here's where you go if you have a question and you need it answered. And I think it's great to have something with that kind of focus.
Well, I think it's necessary to have something like that kind of focus. I don't know why we haven't tried. Maybe we've just been so busy. But after we started getting it rolling, it seems like it solves so many problems. So for example, in Slack, we have a BizDev dev channel, and it's all the developers and our BizDev guy. He can just ask any questions. Hey, a client wants to know about this, or a client wants to know about that, or what would be the best approach for this? So I'll take his question that he asks in the Slack channel, and I'll put it in an FAQ section on the playbook. So that way, as we go, we're just self-documenting and we're answering those questions. So if it comes up again, he's got the answer for it. And it's something that is useful enough that we kind of log in every couple of days and we update content or add new content, right? So it's not kind of like a stale thing that's forgotten. Like maybe if I created a gist and sent it over to him, I might just forget about that. It becomes like this living, breathing document of this is how we do things currently at Octopus. This is what we enjoy doing. This is what we're good at. And on top of just answering questions for our own employees, there's a lot of also answered questions for clients. I guess it's kind of like apologetics of sorts, because a lot of clients will come to us and say, we want this, and oh, we want it on WordPress. And so we'll have to go through the whole thing of like, well, WordPress doesn't really fit for what you want. It's not going to be a great fit. It's not going to do what you actually think it's going to do. And then so once you say that, they'll ask, well, what do you want to use? And we'll say Statamic, and then they'll be like, why Statamic? And it's just a cycle that happens for every project. So what I ended up doing is I went to the Statamic Slack and I said, hey guys, what are the reasons why you use Statamic over other things? And I took those reasons and I wrote a document, like a pitch sheet almost, right? And so obviously at the top, it says like, hey, go check out the Statamic marketing site, because that's obviously a good resource for why you'd want to use Statamic. But I answer more nuanced questions like, what about scalability? Or what happens if we just upload large files? What do we do there? Or even down to like, what kinds of servers can we deploy on with this? So it answers the gamut from like general marketing mumbo jumbo to like the nitty gritty, like how do we actually deploy this website and what happens after it goes live?
Yeah. Another thing that we've been doing alongside of the wiki itself is we actually have a RFC process for just about every project now. This could be something like an open source library update. So ImageXJS 3.0, which I'm currently working on. First step there was figuring out what it should be and writing an RFC. So you write out a description of the project. So anybody, even if they've never heard of the project before, can look at this document and say, oh, okay, that makes sense. Then you write about the motivation. You write about why this has to be done and what problems it's solving. You write about the implementation, how it's actually going to be done. You write about the details of the implementation. You write about, in the case of a library update, you'll say, this is what the API interface will probably look like. You write about all these things. You circulate that document, and that can be in Slack or whatever. Get feedback on it, and then from there, that turns into something that lives in the wiki. So you first put out a request for comment with a fully formed idea, then get feedback on it and iterate from there. And it's been a super, super healthy process, and I'm very happy with it. And this isn't just for code either. This can be for other stuff. So for example, right now I'm working on setting up a code of conduct for all ImageX community stuff. So that'll apply to our Slack. It'll apply to people contributing to our open source projects. It'll apply to anything we're doing at conferences, meetups, all that kind of stuff. It's just a global, here's the expected behavior from attendees and employees of ImageX. And first thing I did, write up an RFC. There wasn't any code, but it still required an explanation of what it is, why it's necessary, and how we're actually going to make it happen. And so that RFC process has been super, super valuable for us so far.
That's a really good point, because what I ended up doing was I went and created a new taxonomy called discipline, and I added a discipline for each discipline of our business, and that'd be like development, design, business dev, project management. And so basically by doing this, we're opening it up to the company to share anything that they're excited about, they're passionate about, they're learning about, or anything that they think might be useful for any other discipline to know about. And it's just really what it's done is it's people have been getting excited about stuff, different technologies. A couple of our devs are super into Elixir right now. So I said, hey, throw up an Elixir page and just dump all of your knowledge onto it, right? Because that could be useful. But what it's doing is it's really actively encouraging sharing throughout the company, which is something that wasn't necessarily happening a lot. There's lots of kind of one-to-one Slack chats going on, but there wasn't like a company-wide brain dump of knowledge. And what I'm finding is that by sharing things there, it's kind of stoking the fire for other people. You know, other people are seeing that other people within the company are excited about things, and it kind of motivates them as well. So it's, you know, I feel like it's increased productivity, it's increased learning, it's increased sharing and communication. So, I mean, everything that's coming from this so far has been great, which I think is kind of mind-blowing, seeing as it was such a simple such a simple thing to implement. So, Paul, I really have a question that I need you to answer.
All right, what's up, Sean?
Do you like programming books?
I do like programming books. I have a pretty nice collection of programming books that I'm looking at right now. Most of them are unread, I'm not going to lie. But I do really enjoy them.
You know what's funny? I have, underneath my monitor, two JavaScript books I have not read.
Well, yeah, but I mean, they're holding your monitor up, so you can't really read them now.
Yes, and they...
Yeah,
they,
that would just be inconvenient.
Those books together make up the perfect height to make sure my neck does not get sore.
You know, I do really like programming books, and I like sitting down with a good programming book and reading it. But I don't generally read programming books if I, for example, want to get into a new language or something like that. That's generally not my approach. Usually, if I'm already pretty well versed in a language, so let's use Ruby as an example. As somebody who knows Ruby pretty well, I am more likely to read programming books about Ruby on advanced topics, because I always find that there's always so many tutorials out there for beginners, and there's so many resources to help you get started. But then learning advanced design patterns and, you know, more in-depth stuff, I for me at least, that's where the real value of books comes in.
Yeah, that's a really good approach. I actually find myself doing the same thing with one exception. So Josiah and I were talking maybe last week, and he, as I mentioned earlier, there, you know, a couple of our devs are really into Elixir and Phoenix, and he pulled up three different books and said, which one do you think I should get? And we looked at each of them and at the reviews and everything, and it turns out that two of them were more reference-oriented, and one of them was more cookbook-oriented. And my answer immediately was, get the cookbook. Hands down, get the cookbook. And so you mentioned that, you know, when you're reading a programming book, it's generally a book on a more advanced topic for a specific language that you might already be familiar with. And what I see in my mind is that when you're looking at a programming language or looking at learning a programming language, you kind of see the tip of the iceberg, right? And a lot of the times you're not going to go out and buy a straight up advanced topic book for a programming language you don't know. So you probably will go out and get a book that covers the basics. And it's kind of like you're on a boat, right? And you're looking at this iceberg, and you buy a book that shows you the top of the iceberg, and that's fine, but it was already visible. You know, all the blog posts kind of shine light on it, all the different articles, different like YouTube videos and stuff shine a light on it. And so what I find to be a much more efficient path is consume all the free resources you can and try to just build something simple, something you've built before with it, because you already understand concepts there. You don't have to think about how you're going to build an app. You're going to have to think about how you're going to use the new technology you want to learn to build that app, right? So then you simplify the things that you need to learn. You cut it in half, essentially. And so when you're kind of familiar with the top of the iceberg, you would buy more advanced topic books, which would shine light on the different parts that are underneath the water that aren't like immediately visible from a distance, right? And so that's what I was thinking about a lot this morning. So recently I picked up Node.js, and I decided to use Happy for my server framework. And the first thing I did was went and looked at a book, and I ended up purchasing Happy.js in Action, and it was perfect. So it wasn't necessarily a cookbook book, but it's not a reference book. And so what it does is it walks you through building an application, and it walks through the most repetitive things, like obviously your app's going to have user authentication and authorization. Your app's probably going to have some sort of file upload. Your app's probably going to have some sort of logging structure, right? So what it does is it walks through all these different pieces. And as I was working on my side project that I'm working on with Node, I was thinking, oh, I have to do this now. Oh, there's a chapter on it. Let me read through the chapter. It easily sped up my development time.
Totally. Yeah, I think really my favorite programming books are just documentation and source. I love reading source code. I love reading well-written docs. I find that very relaxing, and it's always the least abstracted way to learn, right? Because the source is obviously what's actually running on the computer. So if you read through the source of whatever it is you're using, whether that's Angular or React or Vue or something in Ruby or Python, it doesn't really matter. Reading through some of the source, especially when you have questions, if you're like, I don't know, how does Active Record work? Pop open the class. I mean, it's all open source. Just go take a look at it, read through it a little bit, and you'll learn a lot. That's really the way I learn most of my day-to-day stuff. It's very hard for me to read a book and just retain that knowledge without actually building something in the language the book is talking about or the framework the book is talking about. I really learn best by doing. And this varies from person to person, of course, but that's just kind of how it works out for me in books in general.
Well, that's exactly how it works out for me as well. I find that if I take a book and I start reading, I will immediately get distracted. Well, not immediately, but maybe like 10 minutes down the road, I'll get distracted. And I'll end up forgetting what I was doing, or I'll read a bunch and retain it for a few days, and then it'll slowly drift away because I've had to work on other things since then. So for me, the cookbook style book is perfect because if I'm working on something, I need to know how to do that. Say we're working with image uploads. Actually, that's what I plan on doing today is hooking up S3 image uploads to my Happy app. And there's a whole chapter on uploading files in the book that I have. So it's not like I'm reading a reference about Happy and how it's constructed in the parts of the API. I'm reading more of a, this is how you might solve this problem with Happy. And oh, by the way, here are things that Happy has along the way, right? But I will 100% remember the concepts that come through building that piece because I'm reading an example and I'm building it myself. So I'm kind of doing two things at once, right? I'm learning on demand and I'm reinforcing that learning. And that's the big thing is that I tend to, if I do get a book that's more reference oriented, I'll read it, but I won't actually put any of that into action and I'll forget it.
I'm so happy that you said learning on demand because that's a thing that we've talked about before. And it's all coming back around to that where you need to know how to upload images because that's the next thing you need for this app. It's not just learning it for its own sake. It's learning it because you actually need to implement it. And I think that is such a powerful way to learn. Learning the thing as you do it will make it stick in your head so well every time. At least I think for both of us, that's 100% the case.
It's 150% the case. And to take it even one step farther.
It's not mathematically possible.
To take it even one step farther, this is like DNC inception right now. So a few episodes ago, I can't remember exactly when, we talked about the article where someone was talking about programming after 40 or 40 years, and they're just kind of sharing insight. And he said one of the most important parts of having experience is teaching and sending the elevator down. So what we've actually been doing with the Octopus Playbook is if there's something that I had to learn how to do for an application, I'll just take that kind of like a basic walkthrough. I'll write it up and I'll put it in the playbook. And so that way it's there for all the other developers and they're doing the same thing, right? So Josiah has a lot more backend experience than I do. And what he's doing is he's kind of documenting some things that he's done in the past or things that he had to do. And if I run into a situation where I have to do something that I don't know how to do, there could be a write-up for that already. So I saved myself time. There's a document for it there. I saved him time because I'm not asking him to write something for me. And that way I'm reading this article essentially and then reinforcing what I read in the article by building this piece out.
Today, Does Not Compute was brought to you by Rollbar. If you're looking for a great error reporting solution, you should definitely give Rollbar a shot. They have a bunch of client libraries that make it super easy to integrate into any app. You can be tracking production errors and deployments in 8 minutes or less. They've also got lots of integrations, which means they work well with the other tools you know and love, like Slack, GitHub, and Jira. If you go to rollbar.com/DNC and sign up, they'll give you 90 days of their bootstrap plan for free. Remember to rate and review Does Not Compute on iTunes. It's an easy, awesome way to help spread the word about the show.
Drinking this flat coconut LaCroix.
I like a flat LaCroix.
Episode 33 brought to you by a flat coconut LaCroix from yesterday.